Me to say something so that you can gauge the sound. I will. I'll say it's good to be back with you at Siloam at such a beautiful evening. When I'm out of Cardiff, I normally say that we've brought the Cardiff weather, but of course we're in Cardiff, so I mustn't get that remark. I can't allow that remark. For our readings this evening, I've chosen, first of all, to read from the Old Testament, from the book of Judges, Judges chapter 7, verses 1 to 21, and then a very few verses from 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 to 10. But first, the 7th chapter of Judges, in the first 21 verses. It's rather a long reading, but bear with me. It's the story of Gideon defeating the Midianites. You may well know that Gideon was visited by an angel. That's in chapter 6, telling him that God had chosen him to lead the Israelites against the Midian armies, the Midianites, who had been tormenting the Israelite people. Gideon, to begin with, was very hesitant, aware of his weaknesses, and it took a long time before he could be persuaded that, yes, he was the man to lead Israel against the Midianites. So we pick up the story in chapter 7, verse 1. One day, Gideon and all his men got up early and camped beside the spring of Harod. The Midianite camp was in the valley to the north of them by Moreh Hill. The Lord said to Gideon, "The men you have are too many for me to give them victory over the Midianites. They might think that they had won by themselves and so give me no credit. Announce to the people, anyone who is afraid should go back home, and we will stay here at Mount Gilead." So 22,000 went back, but 10,000 stayed. Then the Lord said to Gideon, "You still have too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will separate them for you there. If I tell you a man should go with you, he will go. If I tell you a man should not go with you, he will not go." Gideon took the men down to the water, and the Lord said to him, "Separate everyone who laps up the water with his tongue like a dog from everyone who gets down on his knees to drink." There were 300 men who scooped up water in their hands and lapped it. All the others got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "I will rescue you and give you victory over the Midianites with the 300 men who lapped the water. Tell everyone else to go home." So Gideon sent all the Israelites home except the 300 who kept all the supplies and trumpets. The Midianite camp was below them in the valley. That night the Lord commanded Gideon, "Get up and attack the camp. I am giving you victory over it. But if you're afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Pura. You will hear what they are saying, and then you will have the courage to attack." So Gideon and his servant Pura went down to the edge of the enemy camp. The Midianites, the Amalekites, and the desert tribesmen were spread out in the valley like a swarm of locusts, and they had as many camels as there were grains of sand on the seashore. When Gideon arrived, he heard a man telling a friend about a dream. He was saying, "I dreamt that a loaf of barley bread rolled into our camp and hit a tent. The tent collapsed and lay flat on the ground." His friend replied, "It's the sword of the Israelite, Gideon, son of Joash. It can't mean anything else. God has given him victory over Midian and our whole army." When Gideon heard about the man's dream and what it meant, he fell to his knees and worshipped the Lord. Then he went back to the Israelite camp and said, "Get up. The Lord is giving you victory over the Midianite army." He divided his 300 men into three groups and gave each man a trumpet and a jar with a torch inside it. He told them, "When I get to the edge of the camp, watch me and do what I do. When my group and I blow our trumpets, then you blow yours all round the camp and shout, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" Gideon and his 100 men came to the edge of the camp a short while before midnight, just after the guard had been changed. Then they blew the trumpets and broke the jars they were holding, and the other two groups did the same. They all held the torches in their left hands, the trumpets in their right, and shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Every man stood in his place around the camp, and the whole enemy army ran away yelling. And then a very few verses from the Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 12, verses 7 to 10. Paul has been talking about his visions and his revelations. And so he says in chapter 7, "But to keep me from being puffed up with pride because of the many wonderful things I saw, I was given a painful physical ailment which acts as Satan's messenger to beat me and keep me from being proud. 3 times I prayed to the Lord about this and asked him to take it away. But his answer was, 'My grace is all you need, for my power is greatest when you are weak.' I am most happy then to be proud of my weaknesses in order to feel the protection of Christ's power over me. I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. The book of Judges is not perhaps one of the books of the Bible we often turn to, perhaps in our daily devotions and our readings, nor, if I may say so, is the book of Judges normally regarded as very fertile ground for preachers. There aren't many characters, if you'll excuse me calling them that, there aren't many characters in Judges for preachers to latch onto, discuss their strengths and weaknesses perhaps, and then draw some lessons for us as Christians today. Though there are 4 immortals from the book of Judges mentioned in the gallery of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, there are only 2 or 3 characters in Judges that preachers can do much with, I would suggest. Perhaps you will disagree. But to me, the 2 most obvious ones are Samson, of course, signified by strength, and there's Gideon, signified at the outset, at least, by spiritual immaturity and weakness, as I mentioned earlier, something we can read about in chapter 6. If we see, if we read Judges chapter 6, we see the angel of the Lord coming to tell Gideon he was God's choice to lead Israel into battle against the ruling Midianites. But Gideon's response is one of doubt and hesitation when he's first told about the commission. Later we see him still doubting and asking God for signs of reassurance that he was truly the man chosen for this awesome task. His weaknesses are there in the book of Judges for all to see. Talk of weakness is something the church is all too familiar with these days. The 2011 census data on religion, released at the end of last year, showed that since 2001, around 1,100 people every single day over the previous 10 years had decided that Christianity was just not for them. The population has grown by 4 million, apparently, but there are 4 million fewer Christians. Wales appeared in the census as being the region, they call us a region, that's what the census people call us, the region of England and Wales, with the highest proportion of inhabitants, 32%, ticking the no religion box. Blaenau Gwent and Caerphilly were at the top of the list of local authority areas reporting no religion, both at 41%. The census figures have been interpreted by the media and by others as representing a weakening church. Churches are emptying, they say. The remaining faithful huddle together for irrelevant and deluded mutterings, say our critics. They maintain that we have come to the inevitable point in history when the only logical thing to do is embrace the sort of scientific materialism espoused by people like Richard Dawkins. The final demise of all this superstition and authoritarian moralizing is finally within sight, they declare, rubbing their hands with glee. It looks as if that atheist billboard campaign with the words, if you're not religious, for God's sakes, say so, a campaign that was run before the census took place, it looks as if it did the trick after all. Or did it? The census is a useful national picture of how our society is changing over time in many ways. When it comes to religion, though, we need to remember that it measures loose affiliation. It doesn't look at practice, knowledge, belonging, or belief. Despite this, the statistics are used by government for targeting equality initiatives. The fact that 33 million, 59.3% of adults in England and Wales still identify with Christianity doesn't mean that the churches are full to bursting or that this is a Christian country. In fact, 72% of people, that was the figure in 2001, 72% identifying with Christianity didn't make this a Christian country. And come to think of it, 100% of people identified in the census with Christianity still wouldn't mean the churches would be full. Loose affiliation is one thing. Practice, knowledge, and commitment is quite another. Writing in an article on the Evangelical Alliance website, Paul Bickley asked, who was it that said the word Christian is best used as a noun, not an adjective? He went on to say, in the same way, and in spite of the humanist crowing over the results of the census, which, incidentally, they'd hitherto claimed to be fundamentally flawed, despite this, the upturn in the no religion category doesn't mean that millions of people have learnt the virtues of scientific materialism or will be celebrating hatchings, matchings, and dispatchings with humanist ceremonies. Recent research shows that many of those who say they're not religious still believe in heaven, life after death, and the resurrection of Jesus, among other things. Our society, argues Paul Bickley, is neither Christian nor secular, but awkwardly plural. In other words, what he's saying is that most people in our society are indifferent. Indifferent to the gospel message of love and forgiveness. But we didn't need a census to tell us that, did we? We knew that already, sadly. Now, I'm not saying we should be complacent at all. The 13% decline in those who have got this sense of affiliation to Christianity illustrates a drop in the temperature. A society that was warm to Christianity is now a little colder. There are real challenges, but the challenge is exactly the same as that faced by the earliest followers of Jesus Christ, which is to articulate the gospel in a highly plural culture. In the Old Testament, Gideon, when he'd got over his doubting, made a census of his own. He made a census of the men he had at his disposal to go and fight the Midianites. He found he had 32,000. Too many. God told him, carry out another census and find out how many of them are cowards. Well, God didn't exactly use the word cowards. What God said was, the men you have are too many for me to give them victory over the Midianites. They might think that they had won by themselves, and so give me no credit. Announce to the people, anyone who is afraid should go back home, and we will stay here at Mount Gilead. And so, 22,000 frightened men went home, but 10,000 stayed. By my reckoning, but I was never any good at maths, by my reckoning, that's a desertion rate of about 70%. Far more than the numbers who say they've deserted the Christian faith in the last 10 years, so take heart. But even 10,000 men was a figure too high for God. He suggested that Gideon carry out another census, this time one that was a little more complicated. God asked Gideon to take his men down to the water at the spring of Harod and distinguish between those who drank by scooping up the water and lapping it, and those who got down on their knees to drink. It reminds me of a technique once used by some employers to test a candidate for a job. I know it used to happen because on one occasion it did happen to me. You were taken for a meal as part of the interview, and the dessert always included plums and custard. Provided you knew how to dispose of the plum stones in your dessert, then you were still considered to be in the running. Spit them out, or swallow them, very dangerous, and you'd be getting your coat. Use your spoon to bring them delicately from your mouth to rest on the edge of the bowl, and you could stay a little longer. Gideon used a similar table manners test at the spring of Harod, and found to his dismay that he only had 300 fighting men left. But God reassured him, I'll rescue you, and I'll give you victory with the 300 men who lapped the water. Tell everyone else to go home. Commentators have differed over why God should choose those who lapped the water rather than those who knelt to drink it. But Michael Wilcock tells us not to waste our time on the issue. In his notes on the book of Judges, he says that even debating the issue means we're on the wrong track anyway. The object, says Michael Wilcock, was to reduce Gideon's army to a force not of a particular kind, but of a particular number. A small core of crack troops is precisely what God did not want. What he wanted was a small core of ordinary men to go and fight the battle. The 300 men are meant to be not an elite, but a group so inadequate in many ways that when the battle is won, the glory won't be theirs, but the Lord's. Until the numbers are reduced to the level at which it is clearly the Lord and not Israel who wins the battle, until then, there are still too many. Why are we so impressed with numbers and size when God clearly is not? God's response to the 2011 census figures of 59.3% ticking the Christian box may well be that it is still too many. Too many claiming affiliation without commitment. We are forever counting heads. God is not. The bigger the congregation, the more confident we are that God is here among us. If our baptisms and admission of new members, wonderful though such developments are, if they don't reach a certain figure in a year, we feel we've failed. God wanted to teach Gideon that numbers were irrelevant where he is concerned. And there's a lesson for us here, not to try to confine God to our own limited way of thinking. God's power is made perfect in our weakness, never in our strength. Something we're reminded of very clearly in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. John the Baptist had the right idea when he said that Jesus must become more important while I become less important. Gideon had started out from a point of weakness. His first response to God's commissioning him to go and rescue Israel from the Midianites was, "But Lord, how can I rescue Israel? My clan is the weakest in the tribe of Manasseh, and I am the least important member of my family." Gideon clearly had a very low self-image. The words of the angel who came to him in the wine press where he'd been threshing wheat must have shocked him. The words were, "The Lord is with you, brave and mighty man." Me? Brave and mighty? Surely not. But God was sure of the man he had chosen. Yet he was prepared to be patient with Gideon, who looked for proof that the message had really come from the Lord. Remarkably, God allowed Gideon to put him to the test more than once, showing him by miracles that his call to arms was genuinely from the Lord himself. We can read, as I said, all about that in chapter 6 of Judges. But as we read in chapter 7, God kept his promises, and Gideon and his small army were victorious over the Midianites. And what's important is that it gave Israel 40 years of peace. Gideon, humble farmer, Gideon, servant of God, but slow on the uptake, becomes Gideon, the triumphant warrior. But it was God's triumph, not Gideon's. Gideon's strategy of arming each of his men simply with a trumpet and a jar with a torch inside might seem a little bit foolhardy. I say Gideon's strategy because there's no suggestion in Scripture that the idea came from God. On the face of it, it seemed a crazy plan, but what it shows is that Gideon had by now grasped the principle that God chooses what is weak in the world to shame the strong. At the outset, when the angel of the Lord first came to him, Gideon used his weakness to try to excuse himself from the battle God wanted him to lead. And it is possible for us to cite our weaknesses to try to excuse ourselves from doing the work the Lord is calling us to do. How many times have I said no to the Lord? It's something that I must consider and pray about always. But God is prepared to be patient with us too. But where the work of the gospel is concerned, if we wait until we believe we are equipped with everything we need before we do anything, then we shall surely end up doing nothing. What the Lord requires is that we should be aware of our weakness, but continue the work he wants us to do by trusting in him and in him alone. As I said, Gideon clearly started out with a very low self-image. And the whole business of self-perception is a very delicate one. We need to get the balance right. On the one hand, we need to be humble enough not to have any inflated ideas of our own strength and ability. On the other hand, we must be careful not to let our self-image get so low that we become spiritually paralyzed where God's service is concerned. And the Apostle Paul is a wonderful example for us here. He was beset by an ailment he describes as his thorn in the flesh. There's been endless speculation about what this ailment was. A recurrent disease maybe, or depression. No one really knows. The American pastor Gary Kinnaman describes himself as a lifelong student of the Apostle Paul. As someone who suffers from clinical depression, Gary Kinnaman sees in the Apostle Paul many of the personality traits associated with depression. Paul, says Gary Kinnaman, was ambitious, competitive, highly educated, demanding of himself and others, insecure, confrontational, and angry. In addition to these traits and characteristics, Gary Kinnaman believes Paul was also depressed. Somehow hell was pounding on Paul, he says. Both John Calvin and Martin Luther, who also suffered deeply from depression, as well as others, have believed Paul's thorn refers to the fiery darts of Satan piercing his soul. In his darker times, Gary Kinnaman says he has learned to lean heavily on God's grace, something which resonates with God's words to Paul as recorded in 2 Corinthians 12:9. My grace is all you need, for my power is greatest when you are weak. Paul prayed hard, begged God to take his ailment away, but God said no. Why? For exactly the same reason that he brought Gideon low, by reducing the size of his army to a fraction of what the Midianites could muster. So that God, not Gideon, so that God, not Paul, could have the glory. My power is made perfect in your weakness. The angel came to Gideon when he was low in spirits and under pressure. The Midianites were tormenting his people, and he was hiding from the Midianites in the winepress. God also spoke to Paul when he was low and suffering from his thorn in the flesh. Maybe you've noticed in the Bible that it's when people are low and at their weakest that God often appears to speak to them. The Old Testament has many instances of angels appearing to individuals at a time when they are at their lowest. They deliver their messages in the wilderness times. Abraham and Sarah were at a low point when they unknowingly entertained three angels who gave them the message of hope that they would have a son. Jacob wrestled all night with an angel as he struggled with God and with himself about his life and his fear of being reunited with his brother, estranged brother Esau. An angel brought hope and strength to Elijah when he sat down under a tree, just wanting God to take his life. And an angel met the grieving women at Jesus' tomb, of course, and proclaimed the great Easter message of hope. He's not here. He has risen. The Lord's answer to Paul when he was at his lowest, when he prayed repeatedly to have his ailment taken away, was simply this: my grace is enough for you. My power comes to perfection in your weakness. These words, says Tom Wright, former Bishop of Durham, these words are among the most comforting, reassuring, healing, and steadying words of the Lord ever recorded. They are words Gideon had to learn. They are words Paul had to learn and learn the hard way. They are words we may need to relearn in the light of the census figures, but not just that, but in the light of the decline we see in church attendance and Christian commitment in our society today. Having had the Lord's answer and the Lord's refusal to take away the thorn in his flesh, Paul resolved to be proud of his weaknesses. I am most happy then to be proud of my weaknesses in order to feel the protection of Christ's power over me. I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and difficulties for Christ's sake. Paul isn't talking about complacency here. He's talking of being aware of his weaknesses, something which puts him at his strongest in his work for the Lord. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. This is, after all, the underlying lesson he's been trying to teach the believers in Corinth. He's been trying to show them that God's power and human power are not the same thing. Human power often has to be removed and pushed out of the way in order for God's power to shine through as God desires and intends. Paul, like Gideon, had been given visions and spiritual experiences of which he might have boasted. But he knew that the important point was not his spirituality, nor any power of his own, that the spirituality could give him, but God's grace. Paul has discovered that there is a different kind of strength, the kind that's really worth having, and that to possess it, you may well have to be weak. One of the best-selling Christian books of recent times has been Philip Yancey's What's So Amazing About Grace. In his book, Philip Yancey recalls the story of a conference on world religions in which the subject of debate was what belief, if any, was unique to the Christian faith. C.S. Lewis, that great writer, Christian, happened to walk into the room where the conference was being held. And when he was told of the subject, replied, "That's easy, it's grace," and walked away. They'd spent all day discussing it in a conference. C.S. Lewis had it in two words: grace, both as a doctrine and as an experience, is the crowning glory of the Christian church and the Christian faith. The ministry that transforms lives is based on what might appear as a contradiction at first sight, Christ's servants having to be weak in order to be strong, but the transforming grace of God makes sense of what might be looked upon as illogical. When we accept that our weaknesses are opportunities for the strength of God to be revealed, a new day will dawn. When we experience a new spiritual power in our lives and in our churches. Gideon wasn't wholly convinced that he was the right man for the job. His skepticism came to the fore when the angel called with the Lord's commission. When the angel told him the Lord was with him, he answered, If I may ask, sir, why has all this happened to us if the Lord is with us? What about all the wonderful things our fathers told us the Lord used to do? How he brought them out of Egypt? The Lord has abandoned us and left us to the mercy of the Midianites. Perhaps we can understand how Gideon felt. We might be skeptical too, when we remember all the great revivals of the past we've been told about, with thousands being added to the churches. But look at us now. We could easily ask, like Gideon, where is God now? Why have we been left to live in the day of small things in our churches in the West? But whatever the census figures tell us, whatever the empty pews in our churches signify, it cannot be that God has abandoned his people nor forsaken his church. That would be a complete denial of Jesus' promise in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, "I will build my church, and not even death will be able to overcome it." On that promise we stand, firm in the belief that when the time is right, God will revive his church again, even in the West, and transform our weaknesses into his strength. Meanwhile, we mustn't underestimate what God is still doing in these days of small things. We mustn't let skepticism have the upper hand. There is work to be done. The gospel must still be preached. People still need to know the joy of faith in Christ. The missionary work of the church still has to be done, and intercessions still have to be made for those in need. So let's make sure we get on with it, letting our weakness be God's strength. For God says to us, as he said to Gideon, "Go in the strength you have. Is it not I that is sending you?" Amen.